You're listening to Program to Chill, a show about business, crime, parapolitics, and esoterica with your host, Jimmy Falun Gong. This is Premium Episode 14, Novels as Spycraft Part 3, Edward Bulwer Lytton and the Cult of Isis. Today I'm recording from deep within the hollow earth, sipping a Vril and tonic. Let's get right into the questions here today. Today I'm returning to Teleshism's question from before, which has morphed into a multi-part juggernaut of a question. I'm jesting, I'm having a lot of fun answering this question. It's just become a series, basically. Teleshism had asked about novels as a tool of spycraft, and I had talked about different, you know, basic categories. The first one being novels that intentionally or unintentionally disclosed spy history or narratives, either written by spies or not. The second category that we're talking about today is novels that were used to seed the public with certain esoteric ideas, whether written by spies or not. So right off the bat, there's George Bernard Shaw, who is a Fabian socialist. Now, we talked a little bit about the Fabians. Very interesting stuff. But I have not read as much Shaw as I would have liked in order to speak about him off the cuff. But he is incredibly important to understanding the Fabians. Maybe one day I'll go into him, but not today, because we gotta talk about Edward Bulwer Lytton. And I think he will be the last person I'll talk about in this second category. I suppose novels as spycraft, you know, there's really no end to the number of episodes I could probably do, but in this first go-through, he's the last person in the second category. I will give a basic biography, then I will discuss his works, then hopefully we can get weird. Edward Bulwer Lytton lived from 1803 to 1873. He was a Whig and a conservative politician in Parliament. He was in the UK, of course. He was a follower of Jeremy Bentham in particular, and he was also a close friend to Benjamin Disraeli. Bulwer Lytton was made a baron. He was the first Baron of Lytton. In the course of his life, he was Secretary of State for the British colonies. Interestingly, he was offered the crown of Greece after King Otto abdicated, but he refused. Bulwer Lytton married an Anglo-Irish woman named Rosina Doyle Wheeler. They had two children, who we will definitely talk about. Edward kept busy with his writing, his politics, and his constant infidelity, which alienated his wife. Eventually, they became legally separated, which, like, was not usual for the time, right? Rosina wrote a piece of fiction satirizing her husband. Years later, she publicly denounced him. After the public denouncing, she was arrested and placed in an insane asylum for several weeks before a public outcry basically got her freed. Around this time, there had been several public cases of socially inconvenient women being committed at the behest of male family members. And this was just one of this series, you know, of the public realizing that, like, it's pretty fucked up to do that to women, right? Rosina later wrote about her relationship with Edward and these experiences in a memoir. Now, Edward Bulwer Lytton wrote many works of fiction that would later be described as science fiction, gothic horror, mystery, historical fiction. Like, you know, these genres were basically invented by, like, marketing people, right? But before the genre conventions were fully established, he was writing in multiple genres, and to an extent, he sort of helped make those genre conventions. His books were bestsellers, and not just in the UK. They were widely translated and read all over the world. Like, supposedly the first Western novel ever translated and published in Japan was a Bulwer Lytton novel. Like, we're basically talking about the 19th century Stephen King. And a lot of his novels don't quite hold up to modern tastes. He's the guy who made up a bunch of these famous lines from fiction, which are now sometimes held up as bad writing. Like, he came up with, starting his novel with, "It was a dark and stormy night." Which came from his novel, Paul Clifford. The same novel also coined the term the Great Unwashed. He coined the term Pursuit of the Almighty Dollar from his book The Coming Race. He coined the term The Pen is Mightier Than the Sword from his play about Cardinal Richelieu. The English Rosicrucian Society claimed Bulwer Lytton as their grand patron and saw him as a major source of inspiration. Richard Wagner adapted one of his novels, Rienzi, into an opera. Annie Besant and Madame Blavatsky both cited him as major sources of inspiration for Theosophy, and specifically the works The Last Days of Pompeii, Zanoni, and Viril, The Power of the Coming Race. I will focus on these works specifically. The first one we'll talk about is The Last Days of Pompeii, which was published in 1834. He was just like 30-ish at the time. The novel is set in Pompeii, 79 AD, and the story centers on an Athenian nobleman named Glaucus who falls in love with a woman. The woman's former guardian is an Egyptian sorcerer who tries to keep them apart. The Egyptian sorcerer convinced Glaucus' brother to join him in the degenerate priesthood of Isis. Now, all of the characters are exposed to Christianity, which was, you know, at that point, a early religion, and some of them convert. A major part of the novel involves the Christians trying to reveal to the public the true nature of the cult of Isis. In the course of the story, there's also a witch of Vesuvius, who, of course, plays a major role. And the novel's Christians, at one point, get fed to lions. All the drama set to the impending eruption of Mount Vesuvius, which, of course, finally destroys the city. Spoilers and, you know, whatever. So, right off the cuff here, it doesn't totally sound like, you know, whoa, sus, siren alarms, right? I mean, the Egyptian sorcerer with the cult of Isis, you know, that could be whatever if you're not steeped in LaRouchean literature like me. The Witch of Vesuvius, that's spooky, but like, you know, oh, you're writing a horror novel, like whatever, right? This sounds like it could just be Ben-Hur, and there were lots of movie adaptations, right? We will return to some of these themes. But let's continue. The next novel is called Zanoni. I don't mean the next we're talking about. He wrote a whole bunch of novels. The next novel we're talking about is Zanoni, written in 1842. This novel is specifically about occultism, and I would argue that it is curiously postmodern. Although, I guess you could argue, I mean, Jonathan Swift had already been playing these types of games 100 years before, so I mean, you know, whatever. Anyway, the premise, or the conceit, or the gimmick with Zanoni is that Bulwer Lytton said, quote, "It so chanced that some years ago, in my younger days, whether of authorship or life, I felt the desire to make myself acquainted with the true origins and tenets of the singular sect known by the name of Rosicrucians." Unquote. As the book says it, he says he found a manuscript written in a mysterious cipher, and he says he decoded it, and the result is the book Zanoni. This is clearly not factually true. He did not get a manuscript and decipher it, but he says he did. And this reminds me of all types of received literature. Goes without saying that most of this received literature is fake, but it's interesting nonetheless. And it also reminds me, again, of like postmodern literature. It reminds me of alternative reality games. Reminds me of Theosophy's Hidden Ascended Masters, right? But what is the book actually about? Zanoni is a character. It's a guy who's basically immortal. He's a Rosicrucian. But the rule for immortal Rosicrucians, I guess, is that you cannot fall in love. Like, it sounds a little bit like if you mixed a Tyler Perry movie with, like, Highlander and then took away the swords. Either way, you know, the plot, that's the plot. And then Zanoni, of course, falls in love, as, you know, you say someone can't fall in love, of course they're going to. There's a subplot with an Englishman who begins studying occult works. And the whole novel is set during the French Revolution, of all things. So Zanoni falls in love, marries a woman, and then he begins to age. And then, you know, he gets executed in the French Revolution, because you can't have something be set in the French Revolution unless a main character is, you know, guillotined. It's just a rule. The plot is, you know, one thing, but you can probably imagine how influential it was for all kinds of works to follow. It was very influential. And the novel is absolutely baked throughout with Rosicrucian and magical concepts. And people have pointed out that the novel explores, among lots of other things, four types of divine madness that Plato talked about: prophetic, initiatic, poetic, and erotic madness. So we see that there's a major jump in including esoteric elements between The Last Days of Pompeii and Zanoni. The last work that I'll talk about was written in 1871, so many years later, towards the end of his life, in fact. It has two titles. It was first published as The Coming Race. It was published anonymously, and people really didn't know that he wrote it for like a while. The title was later changed to be Vril, The Power of the Coming Race. The novel involves a narrator visiting a friend who happens to be a mining engineer. Together they go explore a chasm and they spelunk into it. And they find that there is a whole world inside the earth, which is populated by like, almost like angels. And they all have like Egyptian architecture and sort of like an Egyptian culture. The two characters learn the subterranean language unconsciously through like psychic powers, right? This race of beings that they find in the earth have psychic powers. The race is called the Virilia, and they have, like I said, psychic powers, like the ability to put people to sleep and to transmit information telepathically. Now, the explanation for all this is that the Virilia are descendants from an antediluvian civilization. Their society runs off of a source of energy called Viril, which is something like in between, like, I don't know if you've played Final Fantasy VII, but the concept of like Mako, Vril is also kind of like chi, or like cum, or like orgone energy, a little bit like oil, and a little bit like ether. The Virilia's culture is also basically like the race of aliens in the movie Avatar, except for their appearance. Like, they're not blue people, right? But they are, you know, something between like Egyptian and like Native American, such as it is. The narrator starts to go native, so to speak, but then they have to escape for some reason. Like, I haven't read the book. Like, I'm just full disclosure here. I would like to, maybe even to do a deep dive on it. Wink. But, you know, then eventually they escape and they have to return to the surface of the earth. Now, many, many, many science fiction and fantasy novels take cues from both the Hollow Earth concept, which Bulwer Lytton didn't invent, but he was one of the key popularizers of this concept. They take cues from the concept of hidden civilizations, and they take cues about Vril, all of which have like antecedents, but like this is a key entry point in those concepts. And many, many of the modern conceptions of Atlantis and Lemuria are based in Bulwer Lytton's novel. Like, there is a sharp distinction between conceptions of Atlantis and Lemuria before and after Bulwer Lytton, is my point. Now, separate from that, various major theosophists have argued that Vril, the power of the coming race, is based on occult truths, that it's a higher truth than simply being true. and they have consistently played with both the concept of Hollow Earth and Vril as metaphors, also to a lesser extent, breakaway civilizations. But theosophists don't always make that line between metaphor and truth very clear. And they make it quite murky. Madame Blavatsky wasn't like, this is metaphorical. She was like, this is true. She talks about it in pretty clear non-metaphorical terms in her books Isis Unveiled and The Secret Doctrine. In her cosmology, though, the subterranean people are supposed to be like spiritual guides for humanity. Like, that's not quite what Bulwer Lytton had written, right? Now, Vril also consistently comes up in relation to Nazis and UFOs. There's a bunch of reasons why, but let's talk about this for a second.
Too powerful to make.
So the main reason why is because there was a book published in France in 1960 by two French journalists named Louis Powell and Jacques Bergier. They wrote a book called The Morning of the Magicians. And this was a very curious book. It was inspired by Charles Fort. You know, Fort, that's where we got the term Fortean. And the book consciously attempted to, like, sort of do alchemy on history and transform it into something new. To that end, there's a chapter in there that claims that there was a Vril society, also known as the Luminous Lodge, in Weimar, Germany. They said it was an inner circle of the Thule Society. They also said it was in contact with the British Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. They cite the claims of a man named Willy Ley, who is a German who emigrated to the United States, and in the United States he wrote science fiction. He was also a major rocketry enthusiast. He was also a major early proponent of cryptozoology. My spook ticker is just, you know, ticking away right now. Willy Ley is one of the sources for the claim that there was a Vril society, though it is not really clear why he would have known at all. Then again, Willy Ley did end up publishing books with Wernher von Braun, so who knows what he knew. Now, these French journalists quoted a French psychiatrist saying, "Hitler's real aim was to perform an act of creation, a divine operation, a biological mutation which would result in an unprecedented exaltation of the human race and an apparition of a new race of heroes and demigods and god-men," unquote. Now, what's really interesting is that, like, Madame Blavatsky died in 1891, so she was dead before the movement started, right? But her worldview is fundamentally not different from the Nazi worldview. Like, she said a lot of things, but one thing she said was, "The struggle for world domination will be fought entirely between us, between the Germans and the Jews." I'm probably not laying this out properly, and it's a very broad topic, but, like, the Nazis were theosophical. And, like, I'm not saying that this is actually what Hitler was trying to do, but these French journalists are writing that as a sort of creative, an act of creative history. Very interesting stuff, right? Also, as a side note, and yes, I'm aware that I'm basically doing a footnote on a footnote on a footnote, but, you know, whatever. These French journalists basically wrote about the ancient astronaut thesis before Eric von Daniken and his book, The Chariot of the Gods, for what that's worth. They didn't invent the concept, but they did write about it before the main popularizer. Von Daniken was a convicted fraudster and a crypto-Nazi. What did I tell you about not trusting Germans with von in their names? Historians have not been able to prove all of these claims from that chapter of the book, The Morning of the Magicians. Though, Professor Nicholas Goodrick Clark, who wrote an excellent book called Black Suns, Aryan Cults, Esoteric Nazism, and the Politics of Identity, it cites a German historian who discovered a group in Weimar, Germany called the Reichsarbeitsgemeinschaft. That translates roughly to, like, the Reich Working Group. And they published a work in 1930 called Vril, the Cosmic Elementary Power. And it was written by someone with the pseudonym John the Baptist. It was published by an astrological publisher, and the pamphlet says that their society was founded in 1925 in order to study Vril energy. Basically, this would seem to vindicate the Morning of the Magicians, although Professor Goodrick Clark and other historians have basically taken them to task still for making it up, even though it happened to have been true. Interesting, right? Did they know? Did they know but simply not have the proof? Or were they lucky? What's going on here? So, that's about as good an exploration of Bulwer Lytton's works as I can provide right now. I do plan to read several of his books eventually. I thought it was very interesting that when I went to Washington, D.C., every time I go to a new city, I try to go to used bookstores. You know, it's just the Jimmy Falun Gong method of vacationing, if you will. And I went to a bookstore in DC that said they specialized in espionage and military history. Wasn't as great as I was hoping, but regardless, I looked through the bookstore. It was okay. And they had a, you know how like sometimes on the fiction section, so it's just like A to Z, a bunch of fiction authors, and sometimes people will tape up like a little sticker, or it'll say like this section for J.D. Salinger, or like, you know, whatever, this section for Tom Clancy, you know, whatever. In Washington, D.C., this bookstore had a little card sticker thing for Bulwer Lytton's works. And I thought that was so weird. First of all, it's not that weird that they would have his works, but that they would have it easy to find. Very curious. Because I don't hear people talk about Bulwer Lytton that often. It doesn't really mean anything, but I found it curious nonetheless. Let's talk about how he was one of the world's biggest popularizers of esoteric spiritual beliefs, but was he actually an occultist, or was he in any kind of order? We have no proof that he was actually involved with the Rosicrucians. They appear to have adopted him after the fact, even though he wrote Zanoni, where he was clearly, like, fascinated with them, right? And of course, Theosophy hadn't been invented yet, so that's out. There were claims that he was in a German Masonic lodge. Which, if you think German Masonic lodge, you might as well be thinking Illuminati. But it appears to be false that he was in a German Masonic lodge. Maybe what we have to do is look at his biography and see what he was up to in politics to maybe get a better understanding of where he was coming from spiritually. Like we mentioned, he was Secretary of State for the colonies, which is a very important position, obviously. He was serving under Lord Palmerston. What was going on at that time in the British Empire? Like, we're talking around 1856, 1860, that ballpark. Why, that was the period of the Second Opium War, and he was Secretary of State for the colonies. Now, Edward Bulwer Lytton strongly and directly influenced John Ruskin. Ruskin is now mostly known for, like, his literary and art criticism, you know, his writing on those things. But it's Bulwer Lytton and Ruskin who established sort of a lineage that leads through names such as Milner and Rhodes to the present day RIIA, the Royal Institute of International Affairs. Ruskin's students included Alfred Lord Milner, Cecil Rhodes, Albert Gray, and the future director of research for the RIIA, Arnold Toynbee. Ruskin's inaugural speech at Oxford in 1870, which was inspired by Bulwer Lytton, left such an impression on Cecil Rhodes that Rhodes would carry a handwritten version of it with him until the day he died. I will quote from this speech. "There is a destiny now possible to us, the highest ever set before a nation, to be accepted or refused. We are still undegenerate in race, a race mingled of the best northern blood. We are rich in an inheritance of honor which should be our daily thirst to increase with splendid avarice. England must found colonies as fast and as far as she is able, seizing every piece of fruitful ground that she can set her foot on, and teaching these her colonists that their first aim is to advance the power of England by land and sea." Unquote. So you remember how I mentioned that Edward Bulwer Lytton had children? Well, Bulwer Lytton's son, Robert Lytton, was Viceroy and Governor General in India in 1876 to 1880. He was Viceroy of India during the Great Famine of 1876 to 1878. That's when somewhere between like 6 to 10 million Indians died, more or less because of British policies. Not coincidentally, Robert Lytton's administration was carried out with social Darwinist goals and aims. At the same time, the British Empire was experiencing the single greatest expansion of opium production in British India. Lord Palmerston specifically did this to compensate Britain for the industrial decline relative to the United States. It seems a little bit like weirdly fitting, right, that the son of the guy writing about a lotus-eating cult of ISIS would be the one to dramatically boost the drug trade, right? Next, the British Empire used India to pick and harvest the occult ideas of Bulwer Lytton. For example, Rudyard Kipling, his parents were part of an esoteric circle in India. Madame Blavatsky, of course, went to India to study. Many of the gurus that would be sent abroad were not authentically Indian in the sense that they had these ties to these foreign occult thinkers in India. Kipling and Blavatsky both used the swastika from India as their personal mystical symbol. They were both also anti-Semitic, and like we talked about, Blavatsky pretty much viewed the world, the upcoming spiritual conflict of the entire human race, as between Germans and Jews. And she used the swastika, right? The swastika came to Germany through German cults inspired by Kipling and Blavatsky and a man named Haushofer. They were all directly inspired also by Edward Bulwer Lytton's works. We've talked about this in prior episodes. Nazism was directly linked and inspired to the Thule Society. The Thule Society was in that same spiritual stew as the Rosicrucian and Theosophical movements that took inspiration from Bulwer Lytton. Now, the LaRouche people postulate that the British groomed Hitler and the Nazis to be a force against the Soviet Union. I happen to agree with that, but they think that it somehow went sideways and blew back on them, which that's definitely true, at least that part. I am quite partial to this interpretation of history, if not necessarily all the corollaries that they then come up with because of this conclusion. Not to get too far afield, but Lord Tennyson, the poet, was closely associated with John Ruskin. He was also a close personal friend to the commander-in-chief of the Second Opium War. He also just so happened to write the famous poem, The Lotus Eaters. Let us swear an oath and keep it with an equal mind, in the hollow lotus land to live and lie reclined, on the hill like gods together, careless of mankind. So I've been skirting around the dope ink thesis. I will just get right into it. I will quote a passage or two. Bulwer Lytton is best known to Americans through his 1834 novel, The Last Days of Pompeii, but he is also both the spiritual father of the Rhodes-Milner secret societies and of Nazi fascism. A mystic and proto-fascist, Bulwer Lytton led the English Rosicrucians, a branch of the Scottish Rite Masons, headed by his prime minister, Lord Palmerston. The cult of ISIS, dredged up in a modern format, was the official ideology of leading British politicians, financiers, and literary figures during the previous century. Its great public exponent was the colonial secretary during the Second Opium War, Edward Bulwer Lytton, author of The Last Days of Pompeii, which first popularized the ISIS cult, and mentor of Cecil Rhodes' whole generation of British imperialists. Unlike the comparatively closed members of the British elite before him, Bulwer Lytton was an outspoken exponent of the ISIS cult, which formed the subject of his famous novel. His popularized ISIS myth was the inspiration for an entire array of warped imitations. Included among these was Madame Blavatsky's book, ISIS Unveiled, and her Theosophist cult. Theosophy was the satanic Bible of the mystic secret societies, including Germany's Thule Society, which produced most of Hitler's SS. Another Bulwer Lytton protege was Satanist Aleister Crowley, one of the Thule group's equivalent in England, the ISIS Urania Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn. Both of these groups traced their lineage back to Lord Palmerston's Scottish Rite Masons through Bulwer Lytton. Aleister Crowley was the tutor of Aldous Huxley, the prophet of mind control, who later introduced the LSD cult into the United States in the 1950s. Dear listener, we've talked about this in prior episodes. I continue. Crowley was a product of the cultist circle that developed in Britain under the guiding influence of Edward Bulwer Lytton. In 1886, Crowley, William Butler Yeats, and several other Bulwer Lytton proteges formed the Isis Urania Temple of Hermetic Students of the Golden Dawn. This Isis cult was organized around the 1877 manuscript Isis Unveiled by Madame Helena Blavatsky, in which the Russian occultist called for the British aristocracy to organize itself into an Isis priesthood. Crowley in turn initiated Aldous Huxley into the Isis Golden Dawn Temple and introduced him to psychedelic drugs in 1929. Unquote. Now then, we don't need to take this conclusion all the way. We don't need to completely listen to the LaRouche people and say, yes, the Queen runs the drug trade. We don't need to do that to point out that Edward Bulwer Lytton's occult views were incredibly influential, and they showed up in some very unexpected places, right? After a certain point, we have to ask ourselves, should we be framing the question as, was Edward Bulwer Lytton in a Rosicrucian cult? And maybe we should be framing the question like, were these cults based on Bulwer Lytton? And it's not like he wasn't important and powerful. He was clearly one of the most powerful people in the world. He and his friends carried out the Opium Wars, the Great Famines in Ireland and India. Their parents carried out the slave trade. Like, what should we take from all of this? Like, at the end of the day, there's a British aristocrat who's horrible to his own family. He wrote a bunch of weird proto-science fiction and proto-horror novels, right? And he was involved in the crimes of the British Empire. Like, that's it in a nutshell. But the devil is in the details. Bulwer Lytton locked up his wife to get her out of the way of his affairs and his political career and his writing. The novel The Last Days of Pompeii arguably postulates that there is an occulted priesthood of Isis. The novel Zanoni explores divine madness and Rosicrucianism and magic. The work Vril explored Hollow Earth, breakaway civilizations, psychic powers, and Vril energy. All of these ideas have become incredibly influential across time and across space. You have to ask yourself, why? And I think it's too pat to say why it's because people like to take a big old bong rip and come up with some crazy stories. That would make sense to me for maybe like Stephen King or something. But when Stephen King is literally the guy carrying out the Opium Wars, that's something else. These crazy stories were coming from the most powerful people in the world. These particular crazy stories are this influential, and they're associated with secret societies, esoteric orders, coming from the most powerful people on the planet. I don't think it's a hard sell to think that Britain's elites have very strange and esoteric beliefs. And I keep tracing a lot of these esoteric beliefs back to the British. Really weird, right? And to close out with this, I will leave you with a very out there idea. Let me just drop this in your lap and, you know, walk away. Let me toss this bomb into your lap like a freaking anarchist dropping a hand grenade on a police chief, right? If you take seriously the idea of a cult of ISIS, and then you think about who funded the terrorist group ISIS, then you end up with some very interesting thoughts. Anyway, I anticipate maybe one more episode on novels as spycraft. I mean, I could always do more in the future, but I have at least probably one more episode or half an episode on it at some point in the future. Today, I used the much-referenced book Dope Inc., as well as the book Bulwer Lytton, The Rise and Fall of a Victorian Man of Letters. Thank you for listening, dear listener. You're on the premium side, so just tell people about the show. See you next week, and God bless. By the way, I think this might technically be a Nazi metal song. Don't at me, I don't listen to Nazi metal. It's just too related to not play this as the outro music. Thank you, God bless.
Designing interstellar craft power, wield its magic.